Group meeting, Saturday, 5th June, 1976.
You said, I think it was 1 week or week from 4, that the troubles we had, which probably recurred because they had not been worked out. Those are your actual words, I believe. Could you enlarge a little bit on that? I found that very helpful. Please.
Yes. We have to see both aspects of this one question. I said that troubles recur because they have not been fully worked out. In Buddhist terminology, that which is not fully worked out becomes a substrate for rebirth, for another jati, another conditioned state. That is how Buddhism puts it, you see. Hindu, the Brahmanical teachings put the same thing. The word they use is vasanas.
Yes.
In terms of modern psychological understanding, it is that which sinks into the well of the unconscious, having made an impress which is not fully worked out. Whatever that impress may be, in terms of events or in terms of thoughts, ideas, whatever it may be, it sinks into the well of the unconscious. It's not fully digested mentally. Therefore, the mental assimilation and elimination process doesn't take place in full. The mind becomes, if we may use a physical word, constipated. See? And that, of course, in the case of the mind, this thing, when the appropriate circumstance or stimulus is present later on in time, comes up again into consciousness or in terms of the situation. Now, the situation may recur in a similar shape and form again and again, even if you have fully worked it out at some time or other in your life. You've fully worked it out in the mind, but the situation recurs. See? Now, what we have to bear in mind is this, that whatsoever the external environment presents us is very rarely under our control. There are so many other people around us in the environment. The state of affairs, politically, economically, climatically, it changes all the time. So a similar shape of events may confront us again. But if we have fully worked it out once, one's inner poise is not shaken. One's intelligence works perfectly if one has fully worked it out. Because mental capacity has grown in us. Now we must distinguish this very carefully from just the memory of the past shape of things and how we tackled it. We believe that, oh, we tackled this sort of situation successfully, or we may believe we didn't tackle it successfully. Now, in both those cases, we have tackled it influenced by our own conditioning, by our own imperfect mind, in terms of what the Buddha would have called defilements, as well as what little capacity we may have. So we have tackled the situation imperfectly. Therefore, to refer back into the storehouse of memory to see how we did it in the past is the wrong thing. There, intelligence, pure intelligence, doesn't function as a perfectly efficient faculty. But if we have worked it out completely, the slate is wiped clean. And in the wiping clean of the slate, what has happened is that experience in terms of something limited and particular in the past has become converted into faculty now. There is no stored up reaction, confusion, resentment, or any such quality at play. When it comes up, therefore, the pure mind sees the thing purely and can tackle it in the right way. It doesn't mean that circumstances of difficulty won't come to us. They always will. That is in the nature of existence. Because existence manifests in terms of the relative, of the dual, in interplay. Sometimes in harmony, sometimes not so much in harmony, sometimes definitely contradictory. See? But when one has completely worked out something, then oneself has the right capacity and the right intelligence, the pure intelligence to deal with it. If one has not worked it out completely, as and when it occurred, then the mind is still impure, incapable, and is liable to delusion, to error, and so forth. This is what happens. It's one great meaning of the emptying of the mind, that the particular shape and the particular limited forms and structures and methods and ways which were employed are completely out. And the mind, what we call one, our own mind, is in complete harmony with the universal mind, with what Mahayana called the essence of mind. And therefore it is this transcendent something which is at play in the midst of any circumstance. You see, for instance, in the Buddha rupas, the smile, this inscrutable smile on the face of the Buddha, you see. Why the smile? Although it is known that the path of a Buddha is filled with unutterable woe, because he's the Lord of compassion as well as wisdom. It's not a cold intellectual knowledge which he has, but the heart embraces the whole world and feels the whole world's sorrow, you see. But because the mind of he who has realized Buddhahood is a completely empty mind, he is in the state of this perpetual samadhi, which is the shunyata phala samadhi. The samadhi, the communion or atonement, or if you like to use the old-fashioned word, concentration, which is the fruit of the void, the realization of the primordial state of pure mind. Therefore, the smile in the midst of the woe.
Thank you.
This question is very much related to the sort of work that the modern psychologist does or tries to do. You see, under the influence of the presence or the teaching of the perfected Holy One, the process of purification, which means the complete emptying of the mind of all defilement, all ill, goes on apace. Because in the presence of perfection, of the Buddha, of a Buddha, or any of the great spiritual teachers who had realized perfect holiness. This thing can happen. You take the professional psychologist. Is his mind utterly purified? Is it utterly free of all conceptions, assumptions, the memories of accumulated experience which have been seen and dealt with the imperfect mind? The physical doctor giving you a pill functions differently from the mind doctor attempting to heal the mind. In the case of the mind doctor, his own mind is the great pill. You see, there is an interweaving of psyches, a transmission of this power of transcendence through the purified one to the one in distress. There is no separate medicine to give unto the one in distress. With a physical doctor, the diagnosis is one thing, the medicine given is another separate thing, and the person who takes it is the third separate thing. This is not the case where the purification of the mind is concerned. And the purification means the maturing of the mind. This is what we are aiming at. The healthy, making healthy the whole of the mind.
Yes, is that how, you know, part of your book it says, we've got to fulfill within us the sort of God Satan, we've got to fulfill within us the God Satan, as you put it, or the Jesus. It's got to be fulfilled, the interplay has got to be fulfilled within ourselves. Is it the similar sort of thing?
It is a similar sort of thing, you see. The activity of mindfulness, of pure, real, intense mindfulness, or attentiveness, you would use which word you like, is within ourselves this Jesus-Judas interplay, God-Satan interplay. Because Satan is the cleansing activity through catastrophic means. See, the gospel story is a most instructive thing, and how few have ever understood that particular aspect of it. We are taught, conventionally taught, that Judas was a betrayer. Was he a betrayer? It's very questionable. What actually happened was just this, that at that Last Supper, Jesus himself dips the bread and gives Judas the sop and says, that which thou hast to do, do quickly. What is the meaning of this? A tremendous transmission of energy from Jesus goes to Judas, and Judas's mind is now capable of carrying out the necessary material steps to bring about the supreme consummation through crucifixion, resurrection, ascension. See, this is something which is really not understood. Meditate on it for years and years, and if the flash, the real flash of inspiration finally comes, you'll appreciate just what that means. This is the kind of thing that takes place in us. Because don't imagine for a moment that the utter purification of the mind is such a nice sugar-coated something which happens. There is no sugar-coating about it at all. It is like being struck by lightning and not killed, but transmuted into something utterly different. It is a transmutative activity. And these things don't happen in charming, pleasant ways. They happen with terrific force and power in the mind. That is why so much preliminary preparation is necessary. You know the usual things. In Buddhistic terms, the silas, the practice of the meditations and so on, till finally you can be free of the whole lot. You see, now you are prepared to be the living vehicle for transcendent energy to function through you. That bulb there will stand 240 volts. But give it a 2,400 volts and just see what happens to the bulb. It just for one single second will give a blinding light and burst, that's all. Now, a similar thing, it's a pretty good analogy, a similar thing happens to the individual. We have heard how individuals who practice specific techniques for rousing up kundalini and so forth, and if the thing goes wrong, they become insane. You see? So there has to be this preparation to receive this transmission of energy. And then the purification and the perfecting takes place. Yes, Ian? You have a question.
I was going to say, could you elaborate more on what you just said about this preparation and then the purification? I thought the sort of purification came first. An application of the mind to purification came first.
Well, purification, the process of purification is the process of preparation. The practice of the moralities is an absolute sine qua non for the holy life. Otherwise, one is merely playing a game. It's like the body being tired, you have been working hard and sweaty and this, that and the other, and then you have a nice bath and you're clean, as we say, you see. Clean of the dust and the sweat and whatnot, and you put nice clothes on and it's all right. But they are just clothes, they are not you. There is the living body covered by those clean clothes. Whether the inside of the body is equally clean as the skin and the clothes is another matter, isn't it? Depends upon your state of health. Now, similarly with the mind. Is the inside of the mind clean? We go through any external ceremonial or ritual or any external technique. When we do group meditation, for instance, what is a group meditation? It's an external technique, just like going to a church and the congregation prays together, as we say. It's an external technique. There are words and concepts involved in it all. As long as words and concepts do not become utterly stilled, which means that the sense activities and the logical, intellectual, talking processes do not become perfectly still and quiet, this inner awakening does not take place. You may feel fine. You may feel, oh, what a marvelous experience that was. And then what happens afterwards? You cling to the pleasure sense of that marvelous experience. And you become the prisoner of that craving to repeat the pleasurable experience. You see, all these things you have to beware of. These are the, I think it is somewhere in the book of the Golden Precepts, if I'm not mistaken, underneath all these flowers, lovely looking flowers, in the garden of the mind, You see, there is a serpent, a poisonous serpent coiled. Beware of getting attached to those flowers. I myself know something of, through experience, these marvelous states and so forth. Then you get attached to them. You say, oh, this is wonderful. Now, let me have this forever and ever, kingdom of heaven forever and ever. That's absolute nonsense. For the simple reason, I get attached to a particular state, which is a conditioned state always. It's a jati. It's a limited, particular, finite, mortal thing, subject to dissolution, subject to death. The Lord of death rules over it, you see. If I cling to that and stay there, I don't grow. What is the meaning of being a living creature? Life is a continual process of making new all the time. We breathe in and out. And in the in-breathing and the out-breathing, there is a renewing of life. A renewing of life. Not merely repetitious. Because in this process there is change. And that change is a change of growth and development. Isn't there? Now with the mind, there is absolutely no end to it. The perfect and holy one, don't think that he has, having realized a particular state, arhantship or Buddhahood or saintship or anything. That state is always the beginning of the very next state, which is the beginning of the very next state, and so on and so on. But if it is not a beginning of the next state, and is felt and experienced and clung to as a final state, you might as well be dead. Because then in actual fact one does become a blockhead. You see, these are the things we don't see and understand. We think of all this analogically. That, oh, just as at school, you start in the kindergarten, you are now the one of the first years, second years, third years, get your A-levels, you go to university, you get your PhD or your DSc, and that's the finish. Now, there you are. But the real PhD or DSc never feels that, never feels that. He feels he's always beginning, he's always learning, he's always growing. It is your, not really good doctor of philosophy who thinks, now it is done and he is, he pins up on the wall in a glass frame, so and so, doctor of philosophy. That's finished. It isn't finished. You're always starting, always crying. So, to crave for a particular state or a condition is to crave for the state of death. Death in the sense of being in the tomb. But if you're going to remain in the tomb always, there is no ascension. There is a perpetual ascension. If you look at the lives of the great teachers, what do you find? You find that their teachings express a continual growth. They do not stay put. What the Buddha put out in his first sermon, what Zarathustra taught in the very beginning, and as he went on teaching more and more and so forth. All that is different. And you can take the analogy of the great creative artists, the creative geniuses of the world. Look at the early works of any musician or poet or anyone. And he matures and matures and matures towards the end of his life. The physical life ends, but that creative life of the genius within him has no ending. It's always growing. Therefore, this craving for a particular state of affairs and this false analogical thinking from our ordinary experience in the world of the limited and the finite, we must beware of that and reject it. Not grasping. Do not grasp at anything. Do not cling to it. Otherwise, there's no growth.
Well, Piers, if they're still growing, you know, sometimes one has great aspirations and great thoughts, and then suddenly you sink into a, well, it's not exactly a negative state, but it's a nothingness. You know, when life, it's not pleasurable, it's not nasty, but it just is a sort of a nothingness. Is it, is it still growth of a kind?
Look. Take your farmer. He has sown this field for 2 or 3 years, and if he's a wise farmer, he lets it lie fallow for the next year or whatever the right period is, and sees to the other fields, you see, and grows his crops on them whilst this is lying fallow. What happens when it is lying fallow? It is becoming rejuvenated as a vehicle, you see, for fresh creation later on. Now it's similar to that. In our own case, we experience a period of extraordinary development and growth, and then comes a state of numbness almost, and everything seems to stop. Now that is quite right. That is the sleep of the mind. The mind also needs a certain amount of sleep. The mind that does not sleep is the mind of him who has realized fully the purpose of human existence. That is this famous sentence, the yogi, that is to say the realized yogi, never sleeps. And of course people think that he doesn't ever go to sleep physically. Nothing of the sort. He'd go crazy if he didn't go to sleep in the normal way. I mean, you can dispense with sleep for a few days, but if you just go right beyond the limits which your particular organism can endure, you'll just go raving mad. That's the end of all your yoginess. But the yogi... but the yogi never sleeps. Or the liberated one never sleeps. The Videha Mukta, as well as the Jivan Mukta in Upanishadic terms, you see, they never sleep. It means just this, that he who has realized this utter purification and perfection of the mind is one who is always the vehicle in terms of mind, always the vehicle of transcendent energies flowing in and flowing out unhindered. And they never take a wrong shape or a wrong form. There is an extremely telling sentence in the Majjhima Nikaya. It comes in the first volume in one of the discourses. When the Buddha tells his questioner, who asks him, but do you grant that you go to sleep in the middle of the day? And the Buddha says, yes, after my meditation, I go to sleep fully mindful. He puts himself first into the state of the Shunyata Phala Samadhi, and then, lying on his right side, he allows the body to go to sleep. Now the mind remains the perfect instrument of reception and transmission of transcendent energy all the time, of transcendent functioning. The body is asleep, And it never comes, and he says, the Buddha says, he never comes to a state of confusion. What is the meaning of that coming to a state of confusion? It means getting all this jumble of thoughts and feelings jostling inside your brain. It never comes to that state. What do I do when I go to sleep and when I wake up? Consider the thoughts and feelings which are uppermost as I go to sleep and as I wake up. But he whose mind is really purified, he is the true yogi. There is no besmirching of the mind which is a transparent light. This phrase, a transparent luminosity, has been used, I forget at the moment by whom. Is it Hui Neng or Huang Po? I think one of the Zen, early Zen people used it. Transparent luminosity. I'm not certain. But it's a wonderful phrase. So, there we are.
Can us lesser mortals ever get to this state? Because, you see, most of us are involved in day-to-day samsara, and it seems to me that the yogis who are speaking of and these holy ones are people that are out of virtually out of samsara. They have no dualities conflicting with them in their lives every day. They're in a kind of a void or a vacuum, or they've contracted out in the main, I would think, which people in this room couldn't do. And is it possible for us lesser mortals to get to that state?
You see, your question is a really valuable one. You see how easy it is for us to think in terms of this man or that man, you or he or I, getting to a state. What we are quite blind to is the fact that it is not so much a case of any man whatsoever getting to a state, achieving or realizing or attaining anything at all. Now this is where the Prajnaparamita is so very useful, especially sutras like the Diamond Sutra. There is no such thing as attaining. No such thing as non-attaining. Why is it put that way? Because what actually happens is that the totality is functioning through each and every one of its countless finite manifestations. Take just mankind alone. Animals and plants and stones and so on don't talk in terms of Buddhahood or the life of the perfected Holy One or his mind. They can't. You and I can do that. So let us take mankind alone. Now, we are isolatively self-conscious. I have used that phrase for the last 8 or 9 years or more. But how much have we really seen that fact? We have heard it. Our intellects, the intellects of every one of us present here, may have given full assent to it. But apart from that, just a surface disturbance of the top layer of your cortex, cortical cells, you see, has it really penetrated into our whole being, that we are isolatively self-conscious. Being isolatively self-conscious, and consciousness is at the root of our thinking, feeling, speaking, and so on, you see, being isolatively self-conscious, we are quite unaware of the fact of totality functioning through the finite particulars, you and I. You and I are each a finite particular through which totality functions. The whole universe is functioning through us. Now it is the whole universe functioning through the particular individual in a particular context that produces the phenomenon of development, growth, fruition, fulfillment. If the individual is wise enough, is humble enough in the profound sense of the term, that means he knows definitely that he doesn't know. If I know that I don't know, I'm truly humble. Because I've seen that as a fact. See? Now, if the individual is like that, then he is able to cooperate with this vision of the truth of the universal process as a human being. And then this universal energy and power begins to work through him. And without his knowing how or why or wherefore, it becomes the dominant influence guiding him. See, if he knows about it too much in terms of thoughts and ideas and particular shapes, then he's talking through his hat. You listen to some of these people who get interviewed on TV when they say, oh, God guided me and etc. And they know all about God. In fact, they know far more than God himself does about himself. You see, and so forth. That's all rubbish. But you do get guided by this thing, and it just functions through you more and more freely, and you live spontaneously in tune with the infinite. That way, the purpose of your existence gets fulfilled. If you or I were to say, oh, I want to be an arhat, or I want to be a Buddha, or I want to be a St. Peter or Jesus or perhaps even as good as God, you see, then of course I'd get kicked out downstairs straight away. But if I do that, then I am hindering this transcendence which is hidden inside me. I am hindering it. Because remember, transcendence never compels, never forces. Never forces a human being. For the simple reason that one of the supreme things that has to evolve out of a human being is the power of right choice within the limited situation. No animal can do that in the way you and I can do it. An animal has an instinct, as we say, which tells him which way to turn or whether there is danger here or whether there is something there. The animal functions in due response and due obedience to the forces acting upon him. He hasn't the power to say, oh, I could do it this way or that way or that way or that way. And the cleverer you are, the number of ways becomes greater and greater. The very clever chap has several different avenues and techniques at his command. The not so clever chap may have at best one or two or three at most, you see. Now, this power of choice, now, is it going to be the right choice? And the right choice will be the one which inevitably is dead center in line with the drawing power of transcendence, which is not a compelling power. You see? And then what happens to you in your life is your fulfillment. So don't think in terms of can all mortals attain this state. No. Because that's a thought out thing. It's a sankhara, a sankata put together in the Dhammapada, the last canto. The Buddha clearly says to the bhikkhu, with the extinction of all sankharas, all that which is put together, thou do that and you will realize the unconditioned. That's what the Buddha himself says, you see. Of course, the translation "you will realize" is a slightly misleading translation. I would put it the other way around and say, the unconditioned will be realized and made manifest through you, the living being. So this isolative self-consciousness lies at the back of so many of our questions. We have to understand that. Then you see, Sydney, one is content with the right sort of contentment. Not being lazy or saying, oh, well, it's all right. God's in his heaven. He'll do the wash-up for me. Mm-hmm. He won't. That's the wrong sort of contentment. Right sort of contentment. One of the essential niyamas in the yoga teachings. You see, the yamas and the are accompanied by the niyamas. One of the essential niyamas is to learn to be content with whatsoever there is. Now that implies nothing passive. To be content with whatsoever there is has the implication of the full and the perfect use of what is given unto you by life, freely given unto you. But if you get dissatisfied, if you get discontented and want more, your isolative self-consciousness has set you against the universe. These are the deep significances of all these teachings.
We can put it another way. We can all travel. We think we're going to Victoria.
We think we're going to Victoria.
But some of us get off at Dulwich. Some get off at Herne Hill. Some get off at Brixton. Some get off at Stockwell. And some get off at Victoria. But Victoria isn't the goal. It's beyond that. Nobody knows where it is.
You see, when we put it in those terms, we are talking in terms of that which is finite and limited. But the realization that takes place with the fruition of man's religiousness is not a particular goal, is not Victoria or Dulwich or anything, nothing limited, finite, particular. It is the immeasurable, the absolute, the infinite. And the infinite is not the opposite of the finite. This is one of the great intellectual difficulties that every religious experiences. You see, the brain, we are so conditioned from the time we are born that we function entirely in terms of particulars and little things. Our life and our vision is a very little thing altogether. The infinite, the immeasurable, is not to be thought of in terms of size, or shape, or form, or anything. It is the transcendent, the unknown by the brain, by concept, by word, by limited experience, by any limited means. It is the unknown and the unknowable that way. Therefore, to use these analogies is a grave error. Where the mind is concerned, the mind is this universal, immeasurable. It was never born. The Upanishads used the single word Atma, where Buddhism uses, say, mind or the essence of mind. You see, it is the immeasurable altogether. It is not born, it doesn't grow or progress or die. All these are concepts in terms of limitations. But the marvel and the miracle of our human existence is that through the limited, the finite, the mortal, that which can display the ill through purification changes in such a way that whilst it retains its limited, finite existence and is mortal, the infinite, the immortal functions freely through it. This is the marvel, you see. And it can happen to all of us. This is the funny thing. This is one of the miracles, if you like, of the intensity of selfless love. You see, in the theistic orders, the monastic orders, where God as a person is the supreme, we all chatter about the love of God, and I feel this overwhelming love of God, and so forth. Have I ever tried to look really clearly and calmly into this love of God? Can I, for example, dispense with God? Can I, for example, cease to pray to God, or think of God, or long for God, or desire God, or try to please God, or serve God, or sacrifice myself for God? If I can be utterly free of all these bondages, then perhaps I do love God. Now, this is something which the religion doesn't understand. Now, transferring that to Upanishadic and Buddhistic terms, do we have this selfless love, this selfless aspiration and adoration of that which is the ultimate real? The Atta of Buddhism is really the ultimate real. This is where one of the troubles arises with Buddhist formulation. Sabbe sankhara anatta. Perfectly true. Sabbe sankhara, the sankhara in themselves are not ultimate reality in the sense of unfettered ultimate reality. They are ultimate reality in terms of fettered ultimate reality. Otherwise, Mahayana could never say samsara and nirvana are an identity, an unconditional identity. You see? Now, if I can have that selfless, utterly selfless aspiration, then there is no I entering into it. No questioning whether I will ever attain that, or my friend, or my the other man who is my fellow monk or anything will ever attain. The whole concept of attainment will be out. Attainment is a limitation. What happens when you have climbed 20,000 feet? You want to go another 20,000. Silly fool. What will you do when you've gone 40,000 feet? You'll just come back. The Duke of York, he had 10,000 men. You all know that. It just shows the stupidity of human beings. This idea of attainment, achievement, it is the emphasizing of the egoism of the whole healthy ego. That power which separates, divides, this is the power of sin. This is the devil at work. You see? Get rid of all that, and then you'll find that the religious life will just sweetly and naturally flow out of you. You can't avoid it.
Yes. So, can I ask, to grow, do you also naturally go through a phase where you doubt the existence but you doubt everything from the smallest to your silliest little thing to things very personal that play or are an important thing in one's life, where you really don't know just what is happening. You just doubt things entirely.
Yes, of course. Broadly speaking, there are two kinds of doubt. The ordinary kind of doubt is born of ignorance. It's born of failure to achieve for oneself, to get the results which were promised by the teacher or whoever it was, and so forth and so forth. And you begin to doubt. You see? There is intelligent doubt. Something in your own experience rises up like a real flash of illumination, and you feel, this is truth. Now, do not stay put and say, I've got the truth. It seems to be the truth. It came so vividly and clearly. Now, question it. Question it in the right way. That is to say, observe it without any judgments for or against it, and see how it progresses and develops by itself. Now, that kind of doubt is a healing, comforting, strength-giving, and putting you into the right direction type of doubt. You see? So there are these two kinds of doubt. The other doubt, of course, comes because one has sought for self.
Rose,
yes?
When we in the past talked about fate and destiny, you said that life expresses qualities through a person in a positive way, and the same qualities can be not expressed at all in another person.
This is a great problem with certain people in the world. They are good people, they are people with undoubted abilities and so forth, but circumstance never lets those things come to fruition. You see? Whereas with other people, whatsoever lies in them is allowed to come to fruition. Circumstances are favorable. We say this person is unfortunate and that person is fortunate. This is how we put it in our ordinary human terms. Now, if one truly sees, really understands, one will see that transcendence manifests itself, manifests its own transcendence in either this way, allowing fruition to come out, but disallowing fruition in the other person who has precisely the same gifts and abilities, is born with them, and disallows them. Now, what sort of lesson has this for us human beings? Supposing I myself am one who, whatever my abilities may be, they are always thwarted, they are always disallowed fruition. If I were intelligent, I would just try to be as quiet as possible and observe this process of disallowing. What is allowed or disallowed always lies within the realm of the finite. In terms of infinity, there is no such thing as allowing or disallowing. In terms of infinity, the whole unit, the whole universe is yours. And it is not yours equally, you see, in terms of infinity. So, if I look at this carefully, in this manner, quietly, with the mind at peace, then I will discover deep down the roots of selfness, the craving for fruition. But the craving for fruition is the very thing that spoils the real fruition. You see, it's not very easy to put it in words. Look, after the sun has risen, we have daylight. And even if there are clouds and so on, there is quite sufficient light to see by and move about. After, as we say, the sun has set, it gets really dark and you can't see once the sun has properly set until the next dawn and so forth. Both are manifestations of transcendence, the light as well as the dark. When the mind is really calm, is really purified, then light and dark have no opposing values attached to them. They are one and the same thing for the liberated mind, the purified mind. That is, for the true human. They are one and the same thing. Look at some of the phrases poets and mystics have used. I have often used this phrase, dark with excessive bright. Paradise Lost, Book 3, I think line 330 or somewhere there. You see? Dionysius the Areopagite. Men like Eckhart, Tauler. I'm mentioning the Christian mystics because when we are talking the English language, they have naturally produced the finest English phrases for this sort of thing. They use all sorts of paradoxical phrases of that time, you see. Take the Hindu-Buddhist, the void which is the plenitude. As a matter of fact, in my book at the end, you will find a little bit about that matter, you see, and so on. So you see, there are no opposing values to fruition or what the world calls non-fruition. The fruition is nondescript. You can't describe it. If you can describe it, it is not the full fruition. It is not the perfect thing. In fact, you never know that fruition has taken place. You never know it.